Welcome to Two Idiots and a Dog, Idiots Unleashed.
The fuck are you doing, Random Warrior?
Hey, what? What now? What?
I don't know. Maybe it's a stew?
Well, I mean, it does have potatoes and carrots and celery, I guess, but I just...
And onions. Lots of onions.
Lots of onions. And lots of butter.
Enough butter to make Paula Deen happy.
Cow... Squeezins.
God, that man is weird.
Anyway, I'm Grim.
I think I'm Zolgar. Kaiju is apparently trapped in Grim's room with them.
She is very distressed about this.
Is she just sleeping on your bed?
She's just sleeping on my bed. Just a quick warning, this is an uncensored podcast, so you may hear adult language or other content not suited for children, the workplace, church, or, frankly, human consumption.
Alright, so this week, our topic is going to be the post-apocalypse, real world versus media. This was actually kind of a joint idea from Grim and I. Basically, the idea is discussing some of the common tropes and themes in post-apocalypse and how it would apply in the real world versus what we see in media.
If you have an idea for a topic for us, you can let us know on our Discord or our social media, but you can only vote in the topic poll on Discord.
All right, so we actually have one of the fancy patrons who decided to get a message plugged in here.
Fancy is a strong word.
But he didn't tell us actually a message, so he just wants us to plug his fanfiction. Alright, so it is Athan Mortis, who is apparently on fanfiction.net. The fuck is fanfiction.net? Who uses that? All the cool kids use AO3.
Yeah.
Unless you're me, then you use SoFurry. Wait, did I say that out loud?
Say what out loud? I don't know what you're talking about.
But anyways, so you should go... check out Athan Mortis's fan fiction if you like, you know, terrible crossover fan fiction. That would be at fanfiction.net and just search Athan Mortis. And I will also try to remember to link that in the show notes, but I'm terrible about forgetting this. So, hey, Athan, if I don't put it in the show notes, yell at me in Discord, okay?
Forget what?
What? Who are you?
Huh?
What?
Anyway, stand back.
Because the idiots are all over the place right now.
Do we even have a leash anymore?
I'm not sure.
I'd have to go looking. All right, so apocalypse, reality versus media. So here's, again, the premise, restating it just so we're clearing and we're all getting in the right headspace here. This is going to be an examination of some of the common themes and tropes that you see in media versus how these things would actually play out in the collapse of civilization as we know it. We're going to be covering a broad base of various tropes from multiple post-apocalypse genres. Some of them are going to be genre-specific, and some of them are going to apply more to the general broad apocalypse scope.
Yeah, so we're not going to be... We'll bring up specific properties occasionally, especially if they handled it really well or really poorly, but this isn't really a talk about specific properties.
And I need to start with one.
What's that one?
Super prevalent. Like, almost all of this has it. So we're going to stray briefly into the zombie apocalypse.
Oh, zombie is the one I wanted to start off with, too. So
I'm going to start with my area of expertise, and then we'll go with whatever you were going to go with. And, of course, one of my area of expertise is weapons. That's my shtick. You know this, right?
Nah, you hate weapons. You are the ultimate pacifist. The sight of a weapon makes you ill.
So, typical disclaimer that I like to give whenever we do this is, I like weapons, just not what they do to people. I find arms and the history of arms interesting. Their real-world applications in regards to people, less so. Just so we're all clear where we're sitting on this, okay?
But, you know, arms just hold things. And, you know, they let us do things like drive and write.
With one exception. I'm very interested in watching what they do to him. Okay. With that disclaimer and joke out of the way. Yes, for legal purposes, that was a joke. Everybody in the zombie apocalypse carries a gun. No, you don't. Everybody in the zombie apocalypse uses a gun. No, you don't. Okay. In the fantastical world where a zombie as we know it is actually functionally correct, and I know we have a couple of listeners who find zombies troublesome, so I'm not going to go into detail on what those characteristics are. We all know what they are. You know what a zombie is. In the fantastical realm where those characteristics are able to happen, there's going to be two primary ways they hunt. Sight and sound. Every time you pull the trigger, you are ringing the dinner bell. Stop it.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I really liked that Walking Dead did is certain people weren't so gun heavy. In the comics, the Saviors, Rick's group thought they didn't have guns for the longest time because they never saw them using guns. Because they were like, why waste bullets and attract zombies?
Yeah. And there are a few properties where firearms are optional. Dying Light 2, there is not a single firearm in the game that can be used by the player. But you see this everywhere, and video games have particularly popularized it, obviously, because, you know, combat mechanics, guns make for easy combat mechanics in that kind of game. I get it. But it's not very realistic. I mean, granted, the whole zombie apocalypse thing in general isn't realistic, but you know what I mean.
So I want to come off of your thing here really quick about specifically weapons.
Yeah.
Also, in a zombie apocalypse, you do not want a katana. Katanas are great blades, at least when they're properly made. But the problem with a katana is it is a very precision, high-maintenance blade. You're gonna destroy it if you don't have the equipment to properly maintain it.
Well, you should use a machete or an axe or no. Absolutely not. In fact, all right. Number one ground rule is no guns. Number two ground rule is no blades. You want a durable, blunt force trauma weapon. Low maintenance, easy to maintain, and critically, easy to replace.
And also, not likely to get stuck.
Yeah. Oh, look at me. I've got a spiked mate. Get that out of here. It's going to get stuck in something, and you're going to get killed.
Now, if you're talking a mace that's got, like, maybe half-inch spikes, that can be okay, because those aren't going to get stuck.
But they're probably going to get stuck, and then you're going to die, and we're going to laugh at you. And then take your stuff.
Yeah, realistically, a mid-sized sledgehammer is a really good option.
Mid-sized sledgehammer is a good option. Honestly, if you can get an asp, oh yeah.
You know what else is actually a really good option?
Hmm.
About 3 feet of steel pipe. Like good 1-inch diameter. Solid steel or like thick steel wall pipe. It is durable as shit. You can beat that into a concrete wall.
Yeah. And here's the thing. If you're not terribly worried about scaving stuff up and cobbling stuff together, you can make a bludgeon out of anything.
Now, there are certain things that you do want on hand. You do want an axe available, but not for zombies. You know, in a pinch, yes, you use it. You use that as a weapon if you're desperate.
Do not use the blade. Turn that bad boy around.
It's a tool. It is there for chopping wood, breaking into things, things like that.
Have a knife on you. But again, not for zombies. You're going to want something that will allow you to, you know, make intricate cuts, if you need to sharpen something, carve, if you need to replace your bludgeoning tool because you just broke it, you're going to need something that's going to allow you to smooth out a handle, maybe cut twine, saw through old clothesline or something. These are tools that are good to have on hand, but these are tools. If you use them as your primary weapon, you're going to die.
And also, the thing I wanted to bring up about zombies specifically was more of the meta scale of it. And that is, based off of everything we understand about science, the zombie apocalypse cannot happen. Not at an apocalyptic scale.
There is a single property I have seen that has explained this. Out of all of them, has explained it in such a way that I can sit there and go, yeah, that's feasible.
Last of Us?
Last of Us, because they specifically grant a mechanism that counters the single most reason why a zombie apocalypse cannot happen.
So, if we do not account for magic.
Oh yeah, because if magic happens, everything goes out the window.
So, assuming we don't account for magic, we're in the world where science is real and magic is not. So, again, something could happen. We could find out we're wrong, but as it stands, there is the possibility that something could create the effect of walking corpses. The effect. But the problem with that is they wouldn't last. It would be a problem for a little while. A lot of people would die. It would be tragic. It would change the shape of the world as we know it. But humanity would adapt. We would overcome, and it would become the new normal. And honestly, we probably wouldn't even lose most of our infrastructure if that happened, because humans are so remarkably adaptable. We just get used to, oh, okay, well, grandma died. Burn the corpse immediately.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We see some of that adaptation in The Last of Us. And again, Last of Us is one that it still plays a little fast and loose with the science, but not as much as most. And there is a new normal. It's just, you know, honestly, it's a totalitarianist fascist regime.
Yeah.
Which, let's be honest, that's actually completely real.
So, what we have not yet touched on is why, with the exception of that property, a zombie apocalypse is so unbelievable.
Because zombies have a shelf life.
Mm-hmm.
The moment a body dies, it begins to decompose. And there are certain things required for the body to even be able to move at all, such as muscles. If, you know, muscles begin to atrophy and they begin to rot. So eventually, the body will not be able to move. Also, this doesn't even consider the fact that how many animals are scavengers? How many animals are drawn to the scent of rotting meat? So unless this zombie thing can transmit to animals, these zombies would be picked over by scavengers and carrion birds so fast that, once again, they would not be able to function for more than, what, a few months at most, depending on the environment?
Even if the zombie infection can spread to animals, those animals now also have that same shelf life.
Yeah.
Like, it ripples out a little bit, but it's still not going to be as pervasive and all-consuming. The Last of Us addressed that.
And they did have a shelf life, most of them. They eventually became fully fungus.
Yeah. Their shelf life wasn't decay. It was the fungal growth reaching a point where the host could no longer contain it. Part of the opening is a description of the fact that the fungus preserves the host, staving off decay. this is one of the few properties that weren't magic based that I've seen that even addressed that. And we do know of fungus, parasitic fungus, that does release chemicals that help preserve their host until they no longer need their host. So it's not even that far-fetched or unbelievable.
Yeah.
It's still a little fast and loose with the science, as you said. But within the confines of that fictional world, it makes perfect sense. And honestly, it would make a certain amount of sense in our world with adjustments.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's the thing. I mean, there honestly, we could do this whole episode on zombie apocalypses if we really wanted to, but we should probably switch it up a little bit.
Yeah.
So let's go move on to another apocalypse that both of us are quite fond of.
Nuclear.
No, you are not going to be radioactive 200 years later. That's not how that works. If that were the case, Japan would be uninhabited.
Honestly, I think the degree to which you would have to nuke a place for it to stay radioactive that long, if it were even possible. Well, okay, here's a question for you.
Mm-hmm.
The elephant's foot, that's still radioactive, right?
Yes, very much so.
So how long will that stay radioactive?
That is an excellent question. And I'm going to do something I don't normally do right here on the show right now. I'm going to go Google it.
So if you are not familiar with what I mean by the elephant's foot, it is from the Chernobyl reactor. I don't remember exactly what it is, but I know it's...
So the elephant's foot is slag from the reactor that went down through the levels until it finally settled somewhere. And it's just a melted mess of radioactive material and various other elements that it hit on the way, melting through the floor, basically. And then that all congealed into this metallic blob of radioactive death in one of the basement chambers. How radioactive? You were allowed to go down there in full radioactive protection, take a single picture, and leave, and you were done working for the day. Because through the protection you were wearing, you had just absorbed enough radiation to give most people cancer. Is that a slight exaggeration? Yes. Is it accurate enough to get the point across? Also, yes. I cannot understate how radioactive that thing is. And of course, for the three people who live under a rock who don't know, Chernobyl was the nuclear power plant at the Ukrainian city of Pripyat that melted down. It is featured quite prominently in a lot of fictional media. It was also the subject of a fictionalized biography that was very popular a few years ago.
You know, I actually have that on DVD. I should watch it one of these days.
Yeah. Now, even the exclusion zone you can walk through without protection. There's a few hotspot areas you still need protection to walk through, but there are, you don't want to touch anything. As a matter of fact, Kyle Hill just released a video about tourism out there being a problem because people keep touching stuff. So if you come across the exclusion zone in Ukraine, don't touch anything, okay?
Touch.
Okay, so the elephant's foot is expected to be radioactive for at least the next 100 years.
So then it is theoretically possible.
If you have enough solid radioactive material sitting in one spot,
you could have a radioactive wasteland for 200 years, but it would be a fairly contained one. So honestly, the glow from Fallout. Theoretically, you could have something close to that.
It would be a lot more contained.
Or a hell of a lot more material than we're thinking.
So most of the nuclear apocalypse scenarios where we get a post-apocalypse out of Fallout, etc., you're just looking at the detonation of devices that will spread solid nuclear material, but it's going to spread it out as a particulate. The radiation is going to irradiate everything within the blast radius, and a little bit out, the fallout will spread, hence the name of the franchise, right? But eventually, it's going to settle, and that radiation is going to bleed off. to the point where it can be cleaned up and areas can become inhabited again. Again, we have real life proof of this.
Yeah. Once again, Japan.
If you somehow don't know what we're talking about, at the end of World War II, we dropped two atomic weapons on Japan. At Nagasaki and Hiroshima. We will not get into the morality or ethics of that. That's not the scope of this episode. But it happened. People live there today. There were detrimental health effects that are still felt today. We are still studying the effects of what happened in the aftermath of those two detonations. But people live there. They're inhabitable. Even the Fukushima disaster. Right now, it is still an exclusion zone. But that is going to eventually clear out enough to where they can go and remove the remaining radioactive solids. And eventually that area will be inhabitable again. But it takes time. Decades, at minimum.
So one property that I think actually handled the nuclear apocalypse idea really well, and this is a lesser known one, a TV show called Jericho. So the premise of it is there's just this small town in the middle of Kansas called Jericho. It's Jericho, Kansas. And basically there is a orchestrated low-grade dirty bomb attack on the United States that's basically... it's designed to completely shut down the entire United States infrastructure to, bring down the government and all the seats of power all at once.
Putting aside the believability of that for a moment.
Well, from the way that it was done, it is one of the more believable versions of that concept. I'm still not saying it's entirely believable, but it was designed to also take down communications and basically just grind the entire country to a standstill. And the little town that this show takes place in is one of the areas that's kind of safe because, like, standard wind patterns and such, it's not going to get hit as much by the radiation and the fallout. And yeah, the whole thing is more about the life of this group, or this, the people in this town being like, well, shit, now we got to figure out what we're doing. And not, we're all a bunch of wasteland raiders now and we're living in a post-apocalypse world, etc. It's just survival.
Yeah.
Which, honestly, that segues into another great thing.
What's that?
A bunker full of beans and bullets is not going to save you. I don't care what apocalypse we're talking. Your bunker of beans and bullets is...
Hey, I got a question for you.
What's that?
Where are you getting your clothes?
Oh, I'm gonna take them from people who try to rob me.
Okay, what if nobody comes to rob you?
Well, then I'll just go. I've got all the guns, so I'll just go and I'll take what I need.
Okay, but you see how that's worse, right?
No, it's post-apocalypse. It's a lawless world. I can do whatever I want.
Okay. Well, but you see how that's worse, right? Next question: who's repairing machinery? Who's dealing with food beyond your preserves, because those will not last forever? What are you doing about clean water after your bottled water runs out? What are you doing about sanitation?
Yeah, there are some survivalists we see in media who are actually the proper kind of survivalist. Burt Gummer from the Tremors franchise. Not apocalypse, but he is still that survivalist nut. His bunkers are not just stocked with bullets and rations. They're stocked with a lot of stuff. And that guy knows two very important things. He knows the value of skills outside of shooting things and cooking beans.
Mm-hmm.
And he knows the value of other people. Granted, it takes him a little bit in the series to truly grow to value that, but...
He's not exactly a people person, but he does understand the value of people. And honestly, he's a great example of... I mean, obviously, he's played off for laughs because that's the whole Tremors franchise. But Bert is actually a great example of a survivalist because it's not just about him being out for himself. I don't remember which, if it was in the movies or the series or whatever, but he has at least once made commentary about the fact of there's enough supplies in the bunker for the whole town for X period of time.
Yeah. And in one of the episodes of the show, where was it? Tremors 3.
I don't remember.
But in one point, there's a problem and he just pulls a bunch of people into his bunker right off the bat. It's just like,
nope, we're all going to bunker.
He's not one of those, oh, well, this is my place. Hell, actually, in fact, there's one point where, and this one was during the show, where there was a problem and he wasn't in town. He gave someone else the code to get into his bunker.
Yeah.
So this is not some crazy hyper-paranoid of everyone. He's paranoid of the government.
Which, honestly, gives us a great segue into another thing.
Which one's that?
The hardened lone survivalist surviving in the wastes on his own. Can't trust nobody. You're dead.
Oh, you mean Mad Max and so many others?
Mad Max, Book of Eli, pick a franchise.
So at least with Book of Eli, spoilers here if you haven't seen it. Give us like a minute because it's a great movie. You should watch it. Anyways, at least with Book of Eli, he pays for that. This gritty lone wanderer dies in the end.
Yeah. And I will say, out of all of the versions of the archetype we've seen, Mad Max is the least egregious. Because Max does have to re-enter society periodically. Or, you know, what society has become. He has to keep linking back up with other people in order to continue surviving.
Yeah.
But there's so many of these other properties, and everybody's going to be like, name one. And honestly, I can't be off top.
Waterworld.
Yeah. Where you've got these lone wolf survivor types, and you're dead. You're dead because... none of the problems that we just discussed about the survival prepper archetype stop applying just because you're a lone wanderer. What are you doing about long-term food? Because I'll scavenge off the land. Yeah, that'll get you so far.
Well, barter and trade.
Okay, with what?
And also, you have to sleep sometime. So what are you going to do about people who steal from people or people who decide that, hey, you look remarkably edible.
There's the lone wanderer archetype is great for media because it gives you a protagonist you can focus on. It does not work in the real world. We are a pack species.
Yeah, Ellen, especially because the lone wanderer archetype in media, honestly, in media, what is the number one thing that happens to every single one of these lone wanderers in every piece of media they exist in?
They get screwed over, or they get killed, or
no,
or.
Not even that. Every piece of media that focuses on a lone wanderer, what does a lone wanderer have to do in that media?
I don't know.
Exist with people. Waterworld, Mad Max, Book of Eli, every single one, the lone wanderer, another good example actually is The Postman, which is a much better movie than people give it credit for. But,
I mean, even Fallout.
Yeah.
Your player character is still meeting companions, dealing with the various settlements and factions and in the region. I mean, one of the underlying themes of Fallout 4 was rebuilding.
Yeah. So the entire reason to have the Lone Wanderer in media is so you can have this person who is an outsider, and you can have them integrate into society, or at least interact with a society. And more often than not, by the end of that media, the Lone Wanderer is less of a Lone Wanderer.
They've either settled down, or they've got friends now, or...
Yeah, and even if they're still going to be going out, they have someplace they can come home to. Someplace they can come back to and be like, hey, these are people I know. These are people I care about. You know, one of the main exceptions to that is honestly Mad Max, but Max was a broken man before the shit really hit the fan anyways. I mean, that man is wandering the desert waiting to die.
Yeah. I mean, there are so many examples of this archetype. And even Max still has these connections. He still knows people now. He just doesn't go with them for whatever reason. And that reason tends to vary a little bit from one movie to the next. There's so many of these archetypes, though. And again, in media, it's either you've got them to be, you know, your protagonist that you see, you can focus on them, or they exist within the narrative to meet other people and reconnect with humanity and tell the story of reconnecting with humanity. In the real world, that doesn't work. Well, my grandpa lives on the mountain Obama. Yeah, okay, cool. I bet he still drives into town to get supplies every so often. I bet he still writes letters or has a cell phone and calls you, or like, there's a difference between living apart from people and being this lone wanderer. They are not the same thing.
Yeah. You can live mostly apart from people while still being part of society, for lack of a better term.
Part of humanity.
You, why would you want to be that?
Because we don't get a choice in the matter.
I did not sign up for this.
Yeah, well, too bad. Nobody asked you.
Let's see. What other post-apocalypse things are great to deal with, great to address?
Those canned goods are not edible.
Yeah, there's that. Canned goods do have a shelf life. Another thing that actually a lot of things don't address, bullets have a shelf life.
Yep. Eventually, the chemical composition of your gunpowder will break down.
And for that matter, oh, you know what? Actually, this is another great one. It's kind of drawn from Mad Max, but it's so heavily prevalent in all these media properties. There are two things that everyone is vying for in post-apocalypse movies. Bullets and gasoline.
And both of them have a shelf life.
Both of them have a severe shelf life. And honestly, both of them are really not actually worth that much in most instances. You know,
I mean, here's the thing. And this is actually a great segue, building off of that, to the fact that what we value now is not valuable in the apocalypse. Bullets. Again, shelf life. Gasoline. Shelf life, and also you're not exactly going to be having the fuel needs we have now because society has collapsed.
You know what gasoline's actually really valuable for? Not your car. A generator.
Mm-hmm. Power.
If you have a generator, you have electricity. In certain apocalyptic environments, you're basically a god at that point.
Gold? Useless in the apocalypse. Paper money. As long as everybody agrees it's still money, I guess, but how much you want to bet people are going to continue to agree that money has value. This is where we get into something that people don't like to talk about. Currency is a social construct.
So, rolling back onto gold for just a second. Gold actually could still have limited value if you have people around who know how to handle electronics and are doing electronics repairs, because gold is actually an excellent conductor.
That is a lot of ifs.
But still, in the right circumstances, gold will hold value, but nowhere near the value it does today.
It's certainly not enough to base your entire society off of its value. And people sitting there, you know, risking their lives for a bunker full of it, like you see in a lot of post-apocalypse media. No.
The only time things like that, it makes sense for people to be like, oh, we're going to go after this bunker full of gold or whatever, is when it's early on and they think it's all going to blow over. If you think, hey, the world's going to turn, you know, get back on its feet, everything's going to get back to normal, then yeah, if there is a bank vault full of gold and currency that you think you can get into and get out of, it's worth it. If you think the world is going to go back to normal. But if the world's not going back to normal, you know what value paper money has?
Fire starter.
I was going to say wiping your butt.
That too. That's the truly most valuable thing on the apocalypse. Toilet paper.
We saw that back in 2020.
Yep.
You know, and thinking of that, I don't think we want to really address, like, super virus apocalypses, because...
I mean, first, we already know how those are going to go. We've just lived it for, like, 3 years now.
I will never again believe any movie that has dealing with an apocalyptic virus that doesn't have people refusing the cure or treatment because my freedom!
Yep.
Fucking people, man. Ooh, I got another one.
All right.
So, this is a kind of one of those semi-common apocalypses, but we usually see it in specifically sci-fi properties where Earth has become uninhabitable.
Mm-hmm.
And so now we're sending people out to space based off of all technology we currently have and everything we know. You may as well just kill them right then and there. Because barring massive advancements in scientific technology, we cannot put living humans on another celestial body outside of our solar system.
Not at this time.
And hell, at this time, we're still hard-pressed to put living humans on another celestial body within our solar system, except for the fucking moon. And surviving on another celestial body? I mean, okay, if we're talking like sending people to Mars... Mars is so far beyond actual survivability yet, like to like colonize yet. We have major needs of advancement before we can properly colonize Mars. And I don't mean, okay, send some explorers there to live there for a couple of years and study the planet and all that, which... We're getting close to that. I mean actual proper colonization.
It's just not there yet. Give it a century, maybe. Or a severe shift in the priorities of our people as a culture.
Yeah. I could see, based on everything that we have right now, an experimental colony on Mars, maybe in about 50 years.
Yeah.
But that, and here's the other thing. a lot of these colonies are meant to be entirely self-sustaining. That colony would not be self-sustaining. We would need to send supplies to it constantly.
Yeah.
And, okay, well, what if we develop FTL travel and find an Earth-like planet? Okay, first of all, FTL travel is still entirely fictional.
It is theoretical at best.
And second, okay, we find an Earth-like planet. All right, we send 10,000 people to this Earth-like planet to colonize it.
Okay, so what are we doing about local microbial life forms? What are we doing about any local life forms, period? Oh, well, there's no microbial life forms here. Then it's not an Earth-like planet and those 10,000 people are dead.
Yeah. Well, and that's just it, is that environment, that is an entirely, well, pardon the pun, alien environment, and we don't know the rules of that planet.
Yep.
You know?
We would need to study that planet almost as long as we've been studying our own.
Yeah, we would need to have teams on there studying it, transmitting data back to Earth to be gone through in depth for decades before we knew enough about that planet to be able to actually send people to it.
There are two pieces of media that immediately spring to mind. I talk about sending colonists off into the deep dark of space and finding worlds to settle. Mass Effect Andromeda and Outriders. And would you like to know how great that works out in both of those properties?
Probably starts an intergalactic war.
It does not go that badly. But in Mass Effect Andromeda, nothing goes to plan. Everything goes wrong. And in Outriders, the same thing happens. They find their perfect world. They settle. Everything's fine. They're getting ready to settle. They're calling in the colonists. And then everything goes to shit. Because there are rules to these planets, or this galaxy, in the case of Andromeda, that we do not understand.
And once again, you think of Mass Effect, and what is a key detail about Mass Effect?
What is that?
The resources and the support is still there.
No, it is not.
Isn't Mass Effect a hyper-futuristic spacefaring society?
They are still limited to the Milky Way. The Andromeda Initiative is about going to a completely different galaxy. The job of the Andromeda Initiative is to construct basically the other end of a gate out there that we can use to go back and forth. But until that's built, you're on your own.
Ah, okay.
And then everything goes to shit. Because that's what would happen. These celestial bodies, whether it's a galaxy, planet, whatever, are foreign to us. They are alien in every version of that word. And we do not understand the rules. Now, yes, both of these properties, a lot of what happens ends up being either anomalies that we couldn't plan for, or frankly, anomalies that couldn't happen. For example, Outriders, it's some sort of spatial anomaly that grants you superpowers or kills you outright. There is no in between. Obviously, science as we know it, that can't happen. But the point remains is that these celestial bodies have rules that govern how they operate that we do not understand, and those colonies are fucked as a result. And that is not quite as extreme as what would happen to us in the real world, but it's a hyperbole of what would happen to us in the real world.
And if you want to see what would happen to us in the real world, look at our own history. Look at the history of human exploration of this planet. How many explorers came in contact with something on the celestial body they live on that they weren't familiar with and died? How many of them weren't familiar with the terrain and died because of it?
Yep. I mean, we haven't even mastered our own oceans. Who knows what's down there? I mean, there's an entire genre of speculative fiction with a wildly varied level of realism about what could be lurking in the deepest, darkest depths of our oceans, because guess what? We don't know.
Yeah.
Because going down there will kill us. Going up there will kill us. It requires an immense amount of reconnaissance and an immense amount of technological planning. And 9 times out of 10, the properties where you do this, they do not have that. And it goes horribly.
Or it's the property is oh no, the world is ending. Well, we're going to send this ark out to this planet.
You're never getting off that ark. And boy, howdy, you better hope that ark can somehow sustain itself, because you're not getting off that ark anytime soon. Well, I mean, eventually they could find a planet and study it enough to find out if it's compatible and then study it enough for us to survive. Yeah, sure. You know how long that process is going to take?
The people on that ark's great-great-great-great-great-grandchildren might set foot on another planet.
Assuming they live that long.
Assuming they live that long.
Yep.
Which I actually do love the genre of media of a generational arc ship, like where the media takes place on it. I think that's really cool, personally.
Yeah.
But that's a different topic.
Yeah. So we've gone over a lot of different varied genres of apocalypse at this point. There is so much more that we have not touched on. So if you want to hear more on this topic, because we could probably come up with more, hit up our Discord. Let us know.
Or if you just want to talk to us about it, if you like have some post-apocalypse thing that we didn't mention that's your pet peeve or favorite thing to talk about, feel free to join our Discord. Hit us up, because we're a bunch of nerds and there are people who are even bigger nerds than we are about that.
All right. Well, I think that's it for this week. If you like what we do, please give us a like, follow, rating, all that nonsense in your favorite podcatcher.
You can also support us on Patreon for special bonus content and episodes a week early, or tip us on Ko-fi. You can find those and our social media platforms and Discord server all in the show notes.
Also, be sure to give our friends some love, whoever the fuck it is this week.
I don't know. I should try to get us some new promos.
Once upon a time, 27 years after the bombs fell, there were two people, a vault dweller and a California girl. They met and sparks flew. That's when things got interesting. Once Upon a Wasteland is their story. Follow Elizabeth Kirby and Odessa Valdez as they pursue their happily ever after in the post-apocalyptic Appalachian wasteland of Fallout 76. Available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and many other podcasting platforms. Once Upon a Wasteland, a Fallout 76 love story. Available now.
Last, but certainly not least, we want to give a quick shout-out to all of our supporters on Patreon and Ko-fi, especially these idiots.
Random Warrior, Rain, and the perpetually banned Athen Mortis.
You know what you did, and it wasn't writing terrible fan fiction.
Okay, but no, seriously, what the fuck is Random Warrior doing?
That is an excellent question. There hasn't been an update in like an hour. Did it kill him?
Dibs on his stuff.